A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
A grain of rice is going to tip the scale. Just remember that, lad.
There's a small bit of a needle there.
Now, come on,
Mayo, you've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Our mission was to show that we're no longer the whipping boys of Munster.
Hello and welcome to a special Irish Examiner GAA podcast. I'm Tony Lean. By any metric, Paul Galvin is an interesting, intriguing subject for a chat, when he's in the mood. A short while back, I caught up, and I mean caught up as we hadn't chatted in ages, with the former Footballer of the Year from Kerry. There wasn't shape or structure like the best of conversations. We went from Cullum Cooper to Kieran McGeaney, from the school classroom to the English language, from David Clifford to Mayo, from playing to coaching and managing. He might have expected me to ask first what happened his short managerial career in Wexford, so trying and failing to throw him off, I asked him who he'd prefer to buy in the transfer market, Declan O'Sullivan or Seamus Moynihan. Enjoy.
That's a nice opener for you, know, fair play to you. Make it nice and difficult for me.
Yeah, I
don't know. It would depend on the shape, Tony, I suppose, and what my options are and what my needs were as a manager. I'd find it very hard to split the boys now from the point of view of ability and leadership, and I'm good friends with both of them. So, I think I might not.
Okay,
I might not.
Who did you least like playing against?
Well, I actually, funny enough, didn't play against Seamus very often. I'd say once ever. It was a county final in 1999, and he was East Kerry, I was Field Rangers. We did actually have a bit of a run-in that same day too, a little bit of a set too.
There's a surprise.
Yeah, but he was the man at the time for East Kerry. They were going for three in a row. I only played against him once. I actually played against Declan, I would say, more county final in 2007. Actually, me and Declan had a run-in that day. Now I think about it. He was a fine spiky man on the field, Declan. Myself and him had a serious conversation going down the tunnel at halftime, the two of us, that same day of the county final 2007. And I'll tell you now, there was no language used, but the points were being made very crisply and very clearly. And neither were in any doubt as to who was going to win the game. Do you know what? Huge leaders. Two of the guys I'd be closer to, probably in terms of the Kerry ranks. I thought body language wise, the two of them on the field, their body language used to speak a lot for them. You know, not the most vocal either, really. Seamus was not the most vocal, Declan not the most vocal, but you knew when they were on, their body language. You know, the heads were up, the shoulders were back, and their body language used to lead for them. I felt That was the brilliant thing about playing with them. I played with Declan more than I played with Seamus. I came up with Seamus, traveled to training with Johnny Crowley, Declan O'Keefe. So I was kind of introduced to Kerry with that crop of Seamus, Hassett, Eamon Fitz, Kinnaida, Crowley. Unbelievable education for me, to just observe. And I was a complete sponge back then. So I came up with Seamus, but probably didn't get to play enough of him, really. I only played, I think, 2 years, maybe 3 years with Seamus, probably my whole career with Declan. So I've done a great job. I've done a great job of dodging this question, answering this question, haven't I?
You have. Tell me, body language is something that I think is very important. You can read an awful lot into body language. I mean, I even remember from your own playing career, you had a very strong kind of I'm here to play, don't mess with me.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in it, Tony, and I think your personal energy, I'm a just a big believer in energy and personal energy, and I think you'll see a lot from a player, and you can find out a lot about a player when he's off the ball rather than on the ball. And, you know, his language before the ball is thrown in, body language can tell you an awful lot about a guy. So I'd be a big believer in it, and I'd look for it. I'd look for it a lot. It's very informative, I find, and it's often very accurate as well in terms of guiding you as regards what a player might be like or not be like. But as regards my own body language, look, yeah, I don't know. I think it was something I was conscious of. All right, as a player, I think probably there were times when my body language then wasn't great as well at times, and you know. I think it does feed performance. Like you've got to be honest. Like, in your body, I always felt getting to my position before a game. I always made sure my body language was good, and I tried to get to my position before my man as well. And I like to be there in my spot and just own that bit of territory if you can. Small thing, but yeah. big into it, and I'm still big into it.
You mean like, say, if you're wearing 10, like you jog over to the Cusack stand side, you want to be there first, like, yeah, this is me, like, this is my area.
A little of that for a time, early in my career, more so. You kind of move on from it, like, you know, there's energies, you look for energy in different places and edges in different places. Certainly early on, that was a thing for me. You probably can never lean on these things forever. You know, it's like any system. It's a bit like any system. Any system or it can make you, but eventually it can break you as well. So you wouldn't mind leaning on it forever, but I did for a time for sure.
Yeah, I mean, intimidation, Paul, is a big word, and you know, everybody kind of thinks when they think of intimidation on the pitch, they think of sledging and they think of threats. Like, but over the course of anyone's career, and I'm thinking of you now, you know, as you became not a senior citizen, but a very established intercounty player and a footballer of the year, can you actually intimidate then by reputation as well of past deeds?
I suppose, I don't know, Tony, I suppose like you look at, say, someone like Seamus Moynihan, who I always felt was brilliant at, if he needed to impose himself, brilliant to impose himself in a very physical, fair way with his body. You know, he was always very good to kind of, if anything happened that he felt he needed to sort out, he was always able to do it fairly.
Right.
It's a form of intimidation in itself, like, you know. That, I felt, was a great skill in a fella, to be able to actually see something that he didn't like and wait and sort it by kind of, you know, sort it by patience. You know, eventually you'll do it, like, and I suppose, I don't know what accounts for this, what it accounted for me. I don't know, Tony, you'd have to ask opponents. Like, I suppose you become aware, I suppose, at a certain point that you've won a good bit and you haven't lost too much. Like, there was a point in my career early on where we hadn't lost a whole lot for the first 5 or 6 years. We lost 2 or 3 games. That certainly, I began to kind of believe in that. And I think it does get into you. Like, you look at the Dubs at the moment, like, I mean, I was thinking about Dean Rock the other day, like, saw him play there over the last week or two on a TG Carr quarter final against Tyrone 2013, which I think was his first year. Kicked 2 winning points off the bench, like 2 huge points. And like, I was thinking about him recently. He's barely lost a game in his career. I think league and championship, he has not lost too many games. And I'm fairly sure he feels that every time he goes out in the field. There's not a whole lot you have to say or do when you kind of get on that winning streak. Your reputation may, your team may go before you, and teams may say, Jesus, these don't lose too many, you know?
Yeah, I mean, no, I suppose the reason I'm asking and I'm addressing it is, like, at the peak of your playing career, which I would reckon was probably, you know, 2009 to 2012, that area, like, I mean, you had been a mark, Paul, do you know what I mean? Like, the whole Noel O'Leary thing, or you can get to Galvin. And now you addressed that very well in your book. Like, you thought, like, you know what, it was an insult to both myself and Noel. And I think over the course of time, and maybe you'll correct that, from being that kind of pantomime villain, there was a kind of a mutual respect for your football and your competitiveness between you at the end. Would that be fair?
I understood it for what it was at the time. Like, I was going about my business a certain way, Tony, early on in my career. And I, witnessing the 2001 Meath game, the 2002 Armagh game, and the 2003 Tyrone game told me there was a way that you had to go about your business, especially in the middle third of the field. And I did that. And of course, when you're that physical and aggressive and on the line, and I always say contact brings conflict. And I was not a big man to be tackling for breaks in the middle of the field with the McGranes and the McGeanies and the Galway boys were huge, Kieran Whelan at Dublin was huge. These were huge guys. I mean, I was 5'11 and 12 and a half stone. Not a big guy in that area of the field, really, but you had to be super physical and aggressive. And I always say contact brings conflict. And if I was going in around trying to, that's why I worked so hard on my arms, because like arm strength in that area of the field was massive, and you had to be aggressive. And but being aggressive, then you left yourself open to kind of, you know, people pick up on it and they say, you know, try him. And, you know, so I understood the thing for a while with Cork and Noel and that. But I think in the end, it was just a bit, I don't know, it was a bit like we were the entertainment here on the side of the field, kind of while the game was going on, you know, which I felt. And I also felt that Leary had more to offer. I probably had more problem. I'd have had more bother with him had he been maybe going up the field looking for a score or getting on the end of things. I think that's a hard trick for a half forward. Like I remember Declan Meehan early in my career, and it's kind of a kick out landing, and it's half an eye on the breakdown and half an eye on Meehan. And it's very distracting to commit to a break when you have someone like Meehan around you. But like, I just thought, you know, it was that bit of panto in the end, and I thought, like...
But he got a very nice text. I remember he got a very nice text on the train down from the 2010 All-Ireland final when Cork had actually won. They'd kind of, that team had finally got over the line, and you texted him that day.
Yeah, I did. I did. That came to light. All right. Yeah. Well, I tell you, it goes back to the previous year after the All-Ireland final. The previous year, 2009, we had been probably, that rivalry was at its peak at the time, 9 and 10. And after 10, it kind of fizzled out. But 9 was a real peak of that rivalry between Kerry and Cork. And we beat them in the final that year. And actually, his mother was very gracious after. She came up to me in the players' lounge, and I thought it was a real touch of class by her. She congratulated me, asked me about my family, asked me about my mother. She made a funny comment, like she said, you know, Jesus, your poor mother. And she was kind of shaking her head as much as to say, poor old me too. Look at the G2 flutes hopping off each other. But she knew the feeling. She sympathized with my mother, because I think she was, you know, she understood. Not too many could empathize with my mom and Noel's mom at the time. But she did that, and I thought it was a great touch. And I just, that's why I did it the following year, because, you know, look, they're good people, country people. And I know, unfortunately, Noel lost his dad of late as well, which is very sad. You know, people to bereavements this time during the current bloody pandemic is tough. So good folk, no more than ourselves, the country people, down to our country people. So I'd have a lot of time for him, and I'd have a lot of time for him as well. The thing was, Tony, it became very instructive for me as a footballer, and later when I went into coaching. I had a bit of coaching done at the time with the SEM, but we'll say, even now when I look at teams, we'll say the one-on-one stuff, the man-marking stuff, it's the one that, we'll say, back then, we knew Cork would do it. We knew their setup. They go man for man, especially with me. He'd come with me. And even if one player in defence goes one for one, it's very hard to have a defensive system as such if even one player goes man on man to the death like you, you know. And my takeaway was, we'd talk about it amongst ourselves. We'd say, well, he's going to come with me all the way. There's going to be space in behind me. If I go here, you go there. And Cork gave up loads of one-on-ones. Like we did, you think of all the games we played, it was one-on-one everywhere. So if I wasn't getting the ball, it was going over my head. I would take Noel to certain areas. Ball would bypass me a lot. But then Gooch is one-on-one. Declan is one-on-one. Darren is one-on-one. Starr is one-on-one. You know, to me, you can't do that. You can't go one-on-one to the letter of the law, to the death. Like, you have to know when to come out of it, because you have a teammate that's going to need you. You have a guy inside that's going to need you to cover or double up or whatever. And you see it in the moment. You see it in the modern game, like probably the All-Ireland final last year, drawn game, probably both All-Ireland finals last year. I thought it was very significant that Kerry very much went one for one, man for man. Dublin didn't. And I think it was decisive in the end, because you look at a couple of goals, Jack McCaffrey's goal and Merchant's goal, probably came about as a result of man for man defending as much as anything else. And I think it's very smart. If you look at Kerry Monaghan this year, I think it's a great sign of Kerry, actually, to see that they may look at dropping guys and dropping everybody. Like, you see Dave Clifford at times was back, and I think that's a great sign of Kerry's adaptation. But I do think one-on-one defence, like, you it's effective, but you have to know when to come out of it. You have to know when you're gone down the rabbit hole and you can't help anybody else around you. Your man's not a threat, and you're nowhere.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what I was thinking, Paul, as well? You missed out on Pio. You missed out on Paddy, just like you came in at the start of 2004. And, of course, Paddy had just gone. And I would imagine he was the type of character, I don't know, did you socialise, you ever have a few points with him, but I mean, I'd say you would have actually loved playing with him.
Well, I did have a year and a half, I had two kind of half years on the panel with Paddy, like, to be fair.
All right.
I made my debut with Paddy, and you know something, I'm not even sure, I still to this day I'm not sure when or where I made my debut, but I actually think it might have been in Ruislip against London. Might have been my first minutes for Kerry.
Right.
I did play a bit under him. My first start was under him. My first start was under Paddy up in Ballyshannon against Donegal. Played wing back. Played wing forward. And so I had time with him. Would have loved to have been one of his guys. And I always say that. Would have loved to have been one of his main men. But I was too young and I wasn't ready, really and truly. But he did try to get, you know, he did give me a couple of chances. And so I suppose I owe my debut to him for sure. And I would have loved more time with him and under him. I do vividly recall, I have vivid memories of his, that the animal spirit that he possessed in full flow was such an unbelievable sight to behold, I swear. But it was always switched on, sensible stuff. But when I've never seen a man before or since in the dressing room to go and light a dressing room up. I remember playing Clare in a challenge game around summer of 02, April or May 02. And I'll tell you, I don't remember much about the game itself, but it can't have gone too well for the dressing down Paddy administered in the dressing room after. It was a major dressing down. And he obviously, like, you know, in hindsight, I think back to it, and it was only recently I was thinking back to it, and he obviously saw things in the challenge game he didn't like. And wow, it was, I was waiting for, like, light bulbs to shatter. But it also made sense, and it was also relevant and pointed, and he just saw things in the game that displeased him. And this was May time, because I remember it was coming into championship, and it was the time of year, and he spoke about the cuckoo calling. It was around the time the cuckoo was calling, and there was a few cuckoos calling in the dressing room as well that evening in Ennis, I'll tell you that. Yeah. So I did see him in action, and I did have a bit of time with him, not enough for my liking. I would have loved to have one in All-Ireland with him, for instance, but to be fair to Paddy, he did give me a chance or two. I probably don't know whether I took him or not. I don't know whether I was ready or mature enough. I don't know back then. I got a bad shoulder injury around the time he first brought me in that cost me a bit of time with him.
Because you and I both know. I was sitting with Tomás in the car one night, Paul. It must have been around the time, actually. I think Tomás kind of announced his retirement from playing, and we were talking about, and he was saying, like, how much he owed to Pio. And he says to me, Jesus, Tony, I actually think he's the greatest Kerryman I ever knew. And I kind of thought to myself, you know, okay, well, you're his nephew and all that kind of stuff. But I understand more, maybe a number of years later, what he actually meant by that, Paul, in terms of, you know, and then you're the same. And that's the reason I bring it up, like, just in terms of knowing where you come from and loving where you come from and loving to represent where you come from. That is something I think that the two of you share. That's why I was just wondering and disappointed that, as you said, maybe you didn't, once you started moving into the peak of your career, get to work with him.
Yeah. And I understand exactly what you mean. Like, I think he was a symbol of Kerry. And I remember his passing very well. Eamon Fitz rang me. I was in Dublin. And you feel those ones. And I felt Timmy Kennelly's. And I felt John Egan's. And then I felt John B. Keane's. And I felt Weishi's.
Yeah.
You know? These are people, important people, symbols of Kerry culture and symbols of who we are, and, like, great people that I think the county is the lesser. The county loses a bit. Kerry loses a bit of its sheen and a bit of its power, I feel, when these people move on, you know. And, you know, I would have loved to have been more a part of that story, but it was just timing, and it was my age and a great Kerry side as well back around 02. You know, you were talking about most of those guys, 97 All-Ireland and 2000 All-Ireland. 2001 semi-final, and I was in there in 2002 until around May time when I hurt my ankle, and that was the end of 2002. But I was there for all of 03 with Paddy. I was actually not far from Paddy when he got the clatter on the sideline against Tyrone, and I felt, it was an unbelievable game. It was an unbelievable actually. It was a huge education for me that whole day, because I was not far from the famous scene of the tackle, all that intense tackling that Tyrone put on Kerry. I was actually very close to that. I was close to Paddy getting the hit. And, you know, it was, if 22 or whatever I was, you're a product, you're a product of kind of your experiences. Like, and I saw this game unfold and I thought, this is a new game. It's a new game. Mm-hmm. It's a new way of playing football. And it was great. It suited me down to the ground, but it also gives you the feeling that I'm not sure where the rules are here anymore, you know, out in the field. And I'm not sure if there's any limits to the physicality very much anymore. And the physicality has gone to a new place. And I do think that day was a big part for me in terms of my education, if you call it education of the game. I thought the thing with Paddy was awful. I really took that poorly, to have a man, you know, of everything he has done to get that clout was, I just said, like, it was a mad day. It was a totally mad day all around, really. And that kind of summed it up.
Kind of, I knew you, Paul, before I knew you, if you know what I mean, in that, like, even in Kerry, and I mean, I'm a good 12 years older than you now, but like, we had heard of Paul Galvin coming up, you know, and we had heard about this. And it was mainly actually through UCC, to your exploits through UCC. But, you know, one of the things that always attached to Paul Galvin was, oh, he's stone mad. He's stone mad when he goes on the field. Was that an act, or was that just, that was you? You know, Tom Ahern, a friend of mine, used to call it white line fever. It's like when a fella goes across the white line, like, he just becomes somebody else and something else. The Paul Galvin now, looking back at the Paul Galvin then, like, characterise him.
I don't know. I struggle with that. I was only last night. It's funny you asked that question, because it was only last night I was thinking about this. You see, sometimes these publishers online, now they ask an athlete to write a letter to their young self or whatever, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I could never understand it. Like, I was like, I wouldn't know what to say to myself. And I actually don't understand the idea of writing to that 10-year-old person that you were. So I would have characterized myself. I don't know, Tony, even today, I don't even know how to characterize myself. I suppose it was just part of my personality to compete. Very competitive when I was very young. Would often cry if I lost. Very regularly cry if I lost, actually, from when I was quite young. And that could be anything. I remember playing with Listowel Celtic under 12s, a tournament with Listowel Celtic under 10 or under 12, and not winning it and being crying on the bus on the way home. And I had this competitiveness that was in me, and it was there. And I never considered that what I was doing on the field was mad as such. Like, you know, I had a lot of energy as well. And I just found there was, I just found the competitive thing, even still, it gets the better of me at times. You know, I find I get too involved probably, and too consumed by the competitive element, even of management at times. You know, it was all consuming to the point where you just think it's probably, there must be an easier way or a better way to compete. More comfortable way to compete. But I would only describe it as, when I was younger, being very competitive, and obviously a little ill-disciplined as well at times. But I loved it. Like, I loved it. I knew no other way, Tony. I knew no other way to go and try to win, because winning was absolutely everything, and losing was awful. And it was a fear of losing, really, more so than wanting to win things, I think, because from when I was young, I had an awful dread of losing.
See, I think there's, in your defence, you know, this phrase, he played on the edge. I don't think you can manufacture that, Paul. You know what I mean? You can't manufacture bringing yourself to the edge. It isn't a flick switch kind of a thing. And I recall even... you mightn't even recall this, but you play, I'd say it was in your very first season with Kerry. Kerry played Armagh. Do you remember inside in Tralee? And you were like just on the edge all that. In actual fact, many years later, I think it was actually at Moss's book launch, I met Kieran McGeaney and we were actually talking about you. And I remember he was saying that day, he was kind of going round to Kerry fellas like, who's this fella like? You know, I think it must have been, I'd say it must have been in your first two or three games with Kerry, was it?
That would have been, I'd say, the league 2003.
Yeah.
Because Armagh had won the All-Ireland. I had watched the All-Ireland 2002 final. Took it badly, like, you know. Mm. I took all those games badly. The 2001 Meath game, I was in the Cusick stand for that semi-final. A real destruction. This is what I was trying to say earlier about the 0-3 game. You can't take the 0-3 game against Tyrone in isolation, because my introduction to Kerry senior football was at Hill 16 for the 2000 final against Galway, both of them. Roaring my head off. 2001, I was in the Cusick stand beside my cousin from America watching me take Kerry apart. 2002, I was in the squad, got an injury, missed out, watched the 0-2 final at home, gutted. And 2003, I was in the squad on the sideline for the Tyrone game. Three bad days for Kerry. And the physicality is what stuck out for me in terms of those three games. Meath 0-1, Armagh 0-2, Tyrone 0-3. Highly physical. Kerry didn't look able for it physically. So that day, 0-3, I'm sure that was the league 0-3 in Tralee.
Yeah.
And McGeaney was the guy in the country that I probably admired alongside Michael Donlan. When I looked at those games, I thought, like, Donlan, a huge player. McGeaney, a huge player. And McGeaney was a leader for Armagh. And I just felt, I don't know, I hated seeing Shamo getting beaten. I hated seeing Dara as captain getting beaten. I hated seeing Eamon getting beaten. I just took those defeats badly as a supporter. That's really what that was about. And I suppose I did think around the middle of the field, like, for Dara to play, for Kerry to win, Dara needs to play. For Dara to play, there needs to be a bit of, I suppose, so, not starting out, but you need to clear the decks for a, you need to clear the decks for a fella if you can, and impose yourself if you can. And that was probably it with Geezer. Like, I admired Geezer, but I knew that for Kerry to get anywhere, we had to start to tackle the likes of Geezer, I think, was what that was basically. And I remember it well, and I knew I was, but it was me trying to make it in the game too, probably, and saying, you know, we're here now, Kerry are here now, kind of thing. I think that's what it was. But
we'll go back, Paul, to Kerry in a while. Bring me right up to speed and to date, because it's now a different Paul Galvin, or maybe it's not a different Paul Galvin, because as you say yourself, you still take losing very badly, which like the Wexford thing, there was an awful lot of people looking at the Wexford thing because Paul Galvin going in as manager, and I say this straight to your face, like, kind of put it on the map for a lot of people, we'll say, outside the immediate area of Leinster. All of a sudden, now people were looking out for Wexford's results in the league. And so, therefore, it was not just with a sense of surprise that we heard that you'd left, but almost a sense of disappointment. Because I really, knowing you as I do for a long time, I was really looking forward to seeing, because you threw yourself in at the deep end, Paul, with Wexford. And I just guess I'm disappointed that you didn't get to kind of get a championship under your belt. So, like, give me a sense of what it was like and what happened.
Yeah, you know, you and me both, I'm disappointed too. Very disappointed. I've missed it. I feel a loss from it, to be honest with you. I feel like a creative loss, because I saw it as a creative project almost, to be honest with you. And I'm still disappointed, really. You know, I suppose, look, I was 4 or 5 years out of the game, Tony. I watched the game very closely. I had a number of offers from Dublin clubs, living in Dublin on the Wexford Road. I had an offer from a couple of intercounty setups. One of them was Kieran Dealy over in London, which I found a very interesting project. That's a word I don't use very often now, but London is probably a project, if anything is. And he asked me to join him in London, which I wasn't able to do in 2019, but I did go over, and I got observed a couple of sessions. Fascinating experience to witness and to live the London football culture and the experience of being a London player. I went and got the tube from central London out to Greenford, jumped off the tube, out of the station, across the road, up a motorway, slip road off a motorway, over a crash barrier, into a field, cross a field, over a ditch, in the back of Tyrconnell Gales' pitch. Honestly, you know, fantastic experience. They were training loads of teams around them, London senior intercounty team, loads of underage teams around them. Actually, before the session, we were in the back room and the boys were getting ready. The back room team were getting ready with the old data packs. And wasn't there a funeral in the bar next door? A funeral in the big sinks. a big sing song from the funeral next door, like, and all these players are coming out to prepare for training. And I think it was maybe a member of the travelling community that had passed away, and it was a big sing song. And, you know, it was just a very rich experience from my point of view. I would have a real grow for London football because of my friends over there and because I love the culture of London town. And so I've having been there with London and been at those few sessions, I watched a lot of Division 4 last year, loads of it. I watched every team in Division 4 in 2019. Great division of football, Tony. Great division of football. Grossly, in my opinion, underreported upon, grossly underappreciated, actually. I actually find it really, really interesting in 2019 and even more interesting in 2020. The amount of risk-taking, happening in Division 4, Tony, may be far the underreporting, you know. You see managers trying things, honestly. A couple of times this year, I was smiling. I was watching games through my fingers, honestly, because we were trying so much because no one was watching, really. I think, you know, there is a couple of dozen people and then no reporting on it either, really, by, you know, and in the general sense, it's,
yeah,
you know, you hear about the women's football, which I'm a huge supporter of and advocate of, and can't see it, can't be it. It's a big thing and I believe in it and I believe they deserve more. But I also believe Division 4 footballers deserve a bit more. What would I say? Yeah.
Backlight, profile.
Yeah, absolutely, Tony. Help, support, ideas, energy, time. I honestly, it was a huge motivation for me to go and do that. I love Wexford football for a start, for its history, first and foremost. I read a lot about it. I'd experienced that division, and I felt they were a good prospect in that division for where they were at and where they could go and what they had done in the past, in the recent past, not just the distant past. Mm. And I wasn't too far wrong. They were right good ability down there. Really enjoyed it down there with them. So, yeah, I feel a little in between about it as well. I'm disappointed that it didn't come to something. You know what I mean? Happy with what I did down there. They're in a good place. They're in a very good place, and good luck to them. I think they can do well. I just couldn't. I just from lots of reasons, Tony. I just feel my energy for it over the whole period of lockdown changed, and it began to feel like an errand. And you know, our living situation. We're in the west of Ireland now since that lockdown. It just so much changed, Tony, from the moment that I actually went for the interview, because it was the interview I saw it more than the job, to be honest with you. And just to present myself and present the few thoughts I had on the game and to get some feedback, honestly, that was really the big motivation. And you know, the chairman and I spoke about the manager's job. I felt I didn't feel I wanted the interview. I wasn't so keen on the job and the manager's job as such. I did say I would like to be a number two. And we spoke with that very frankly, the chairman and I. We couldn't really find the number one for me to be the number two. We did have a look at it and have a chat about it. And we just weren't able to find that right...
Figurehead.
Figurehead as such. And I wasn't afraid of taking the job as such. You know, just that's... I had presented my few ideas and... You know, I was keen to implement them as well. I was very keen to implement them. And that's what swung it, really. The opportunity to go and try out X, Y, and Z on the basis of watching football for the last number of years. Here are a couple of areas that I think should be attacked. And I attacked them.
Yeah. And it's always said about somebody... Well, no, sorry, it's not always said, but it is said sometimes of somebody who has played at an elite... and has been successful at an elite level in a sport, that it's a frustrating experience to go back to, we'll say, something in Division 4. But by the sound of you, you were kind of intrigued enough by the project that was a frustration or wasn't it?
No, not any bit. Not any bit. Because you can't take for granted, first of all, you can't take for granted that players will listen to you and come with you and believe in what you say and try the things you want to try. So that's a reward in itself. And you can't go down there was no point me going down thinking, I played for Kerry now at a very high standard. These fellas are at a Division 4 standard. So, like, clearly, I you couldn't go into it with that kind of a mindset because, no, I didn't find that at all. I'll tell you what I found is a lot of ability down there.
Right.
A lot of football ability. And then I was grateful that guys were open to the ideas and the kind of the go in the direction we wanted to go, because you have to outline a direction and head there. Mm. And you have to have fellas who'll understand it and go with you. So it was way more rewarding than it was frustrating. What was frustrating was the layoff. I found the layoff after a while.
Mm.
The layoff began to take the fun out of it, and it just, my energy for it changed, and you know, for loads of reasons.
Do you think you'd still be the manager if we hadn't had the coronavirus?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'd still be there if there was no coronavirus. I'd still be there probably had the season been knocked on the head. I'd still be there, I think.
Right.
But his inability, you know, there was a real kind of paralysis to it. Like, you couldn't.
Can you remember, Paul, the day or the morning or the night where you actually woke up and said to Louise or said to yourself, you know what, I'm done here in Wexford. It's just wrong now for me, where it was right 6 months ago or 5 months ago, or 4 months ago. Can you remember that day when you actually came to that conclusion?
Yeah, it was only like the previous night, really. I said, that's that. No, it's time to... Because I was heading off, like, I was in Mayo and I was heading off, and the whole situation was getting very messy in Dublin, and it was into the car, head for Dublin, and when will you be back, kind of thing, you know. And I don't really know when I'll be back.
Yeah.
it'll be at least a week, it could be a month. I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, that was it, like, and you just say to yourself, you know, okay, I think it's time now to just do, you know, focus on other things. And I do think it's a local enterprise now as well. I do think an inter-county management is a local enterprise big time, more than it
ever
was.
Why do you say that?
Well, you see, like, how do you plan the thing? How do you plan out your season? How do you have your meetings in this circumstance? Even if you're based in Dublin, never mind being based in Mayo and Dublin, kind of thing. Very hard to do your planning and have your meetings and your backroom stuff and sit down with your players and get to know them. And, you know, I do think you need to be on the ground, probably in the county and in amongst, you know, it's like the club model. I do think it's going to be hard for inter-county managers outside of the county to operate in this current new environment that we're in, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And just finally on the management thing, I mean, you know, you're still a young, very young man managerially, but, and, you know, I don't know what your plans are in terms of the future, but the fact that you're in Mayo now, would that actually, so from what you're saying, Paul, dictate your kind of thought process if an offer did come along in the next 6 months, 12, 18 months?
I don't know.
Do you know my question?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Like, there's been offers, there's offers and there's been offers, and I don't know. It's very hard to commit to anything at the moment. How do you commit to what? Like, what are you committing to? You know, I've got a professional life, a family life. I have a family in Kerry that I've seen. I count on one hand the amount of times I've seen my family in Kerry this year. Do you know? So, like, at club or county management, what are you committing to at the moment? You've no idea. Right now, I've no idea what next season looks like. So it's a very hard thing at the minute. Like, and especially for someone starting out, I just don't think it's the right time, really. I'll see. You know, it was some of it now didn't do much for me, to be quite honest with you. Some of the experience didn't do much for me. Mm-hmm. In terms of you know, going back to Noel and myself being the entertainment as players, I do feel I was the entertainment to an extent as well, as a manager / coach. And, you know, I was awful slow to even describe myself as a manager, because, and I said this at the start of the year, but it was taken a little bit out of context, but, like, I don't even regard myself as a manager. You can't regard yourself as a manager if you don't have a track record as a manager at that level. Do you know what I mean? So I didn't even see myself going in there as a manager, Tony. I saw myself going in there with some learnings from studying the game over 4 years, producing these in interview, and saying, if you go here, here, and here, do this, this, and this, I think you'll improve this team, and I think you can achieve X, Y, and Z. And that's how I went about it. So I don't even think that's management as such. Obviously, there's a management aspect that you have to tick those boxes with regard to man management and managing yourself and managing media, which, you know, you've got to do those things. But so there was parts of it that I don't know what to say about. I'm still kind of processing some aspects of it, Tony, but I certainly, for what I got from it, and I definitely would like to be sitting back at it in some shape or form, but you can't chase these things either. You can't chase them, because if you chase them, you can get tripped up, you know.
When you went to Wexford, I suppose my initial thought, Paul, or I suppose, and a lot of people's initial thoughts was, oh God, the chemistry there between Davy Fitz and Paul Galvin, you know, I'm not so sure that that's going to work. Or like, so, I mean, how did that go, or what was that an issue, or, you know, anything like that?
No, I don't have anything to say there, Tony, to be honest with you. If I had anything to say on that, I'd say it to the man himself, and I'd say it straight to him. I don't want to do my dealings like that through media or whatever, so I don't have anything to add in that
regard. Well, Paul, you're leaving that hanging out there. That makes it say, that sounds to me like that it wasn't a sweetheart relationship.
No, not by any means. No, it wasn't. It wasn't bad by any means.
Right, because sometimes, obviously, when you have strong personalities, and I'm putting you in that category, and I'm putting him in that category, there's always friction.
I have nothing to add, Tony, on any of that stuff, unfortunately.
Because let's face it, Wexford would be seen as a hurling county. So you were basically going in there, I won't say in a kind of a secondary thing, but like, you were going in there under pressure from the off. Would that be fair?
I didn't feel so.
Did you not?
No. I knew exactly where I was going. I knew exactly what I was going into.
Right. Okay, good stuff. Question for you. I got a picture sent to me of your new motor from Fast Eddie there a couple of weeks ago. Lovely Q5, which, in fairness, I know you like to do a lot of thinking in your travels, but it certainly softens the journey, I'd say, does it, from Mayo to Dublin and back?
Yeah, I suppose it's a big part. Like, you think back of Mikko, like, you know, you think back to Mikko and all the time Mikko spent driving. Mikko's favourite hobby was driving.
Yeah.
And it is a big part. If you're in football, the car is a big part of your life. And especially if you're a coach or a manager, it's a big part of the job, actually, being in the car. Because the place I go to make phone calls all the time, I can make phone calls around people. So I have to be in the car a lot of the time to make phone calls. So it does. It's a beautiful car. And I've been in partnership with Audi Cork for 7 or 8 years now. And, you know, it does make your travel, your family life, your, obviously, if you're driving as a coach or a manager, it makes a big difference, but it also makes a big difference to your family life. And
they're a business
and they're brand. I have a lot of good friends in Cork, and Cork's been very good to me even since I started out in college. I've got my education there, I got my first job there. And that partnership with Audi Cork has been great for a number of years, like, and it does make life easier, that's for sure. Makes journeys easier.
And Dwyer, if you remember, I mean, I got a spin home from Dwyer. Actually, I wrote about it one time. Jesus, it wouldn't happen now. Kerry, I'd say it was 1983, Paul. I'd say I was with the Kingdom. Do you remember at the time, now and then, in Killarney? And I was covering a game above in Newbridge and against Kildare. And I had no spin home. And I actually went up to Dwyer for the quotes afterwards. And I kind of said, look, is there any chance of a spin home? Imagine asking that now, like, and no problem. Like, he had Jerry O from Ballinskellig's in the front. He had Mikey Dermot Donoghue from Legion, James's father, and myself in the back, like, but he didn't drive muck either, by the way, if you remember. He was all Mercedes and BMW 5
Series. I know. There's some great old imagery of him, actually, when he had the garage that time.
Yeah.
He liked a good car, and, no, it is. It's the office. For a manager and a coach, the car is the office for sure. And for me, it is. And I would have spent a lot of the first lockdown in my car. And I became like another room in the house, you know.
You said to me there, you recall your time in Cork very fondly. And I know you do. But it's also, you remember, because if you were the least popular Kerryman in Cork. I wasn't probably too far behind you there for a while, like, but you certainly went through a phase in Cork of being public enemy number one. And you, I remember, Paul, and you're not going to lie to me now, like, that was difficult at the time. I know you look back at it now, but at the time it was tough because you were kind of thinking to yourself, look, I'm just being me here. Why am I kind of victim number one or enemy number one here around this place?
Yeah, it was, I suppose, I don't know, it was like, you know, part of the rivalry was very intense rivalry at the time, and I had my way on the field that was ruffling feathers, like, so, I mean, I'm not overly surprised that I was not flavour of the month in Cork for a while. Like, you know, like, Jimmy Deanahan was the one man who was quite pleased with it, because he said to me one time, he said, Jesus Christ, Paul, they hate you more than they hate me. And he was quite okay with that, I think, as well. But I think you came with the territory, Tony, and it got to the stage, all right, in the end, because it got a bit, you know, I got a bit out and about. It got a bit, not that it was a bit tricky at times out and about. So I eventually just said, you know, it's time to get back to Kerry, because there was a likelihood that we'd keep meeting each other, and I just didn't feel Cork was the right place for me. So I love Cork, and I still do. And I'm not overly surprised, like, you know, that I wasn't flavour of the month as such, because my way on the field back then, like, was, yeah, it was definitely ruffling feathers. And
yeah,
I didn't care about that really, because we were going to be, it was either us or Cork winning all Ireland's around the time. We were the top two teams. And that was very important to me. On a personal level, it was very important, like, that team that I was on at that time, at that stage, weren't getting beaten by Cork, you know?
Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to throw at you. Do you remember what you said in the dressing room in Croke Park after the 2007 All-Ireland final against Cork?
Yeah.
What'd you say?
Well, I think I felt that it was, you know, it was a hugely important game from the point of view of Kerry's overall 100 years of tradition would have been affected, I think, like, and it would have been on our watch, like, you know, that you couldn't, that was a big motivation for me, like, you know, that you would go in there and be mindful of the fact that you couldn't really allow, like, you couldn't allow a defeat really in that circumstance, because it would be remembered for a long, long time.
Yeah. Losing to Cork in an All-Ireland final.
Yeah. It was the first time ever. That would have never been forgotten. And, but I was better like that. Look at Kamir. I don't know how many other players thought that way. I felt that way because I was better with those kind of stakes. I was comfortable with that kind of thinking and that kind of pressure. I needed pressure to keep me focused, I felt. And that was my feel on it. Like, and I do study the game a lot and the history of the game a lot. And I'm very aware of Kerry's history, and as we probably all are, really. And, you know, I do think it's a good thing to know it and to be aware of it and to protect it at certain times. Like, I think that's a good benchmark for any player. So,
but here's the thing. I think you'd have thrived in that Kerry team last September the 1st in Croke Park, because it must and should have been a monstrous incentive for any Kerry player not to allow Dublin to be the first county to do the five in a row.
Yeah, I think so. I think as a supporter, as a spectator and as a supporter, it was one I felt a little bit like, you know, I felt it almost like as a player, in that it was definitely a seminal moment. It was a big moment in the history of the game and the records of the game and that. So I certainly as a spectator, I felt that morning and that day and that week, I felt this is a big one now, like, you know, and what better motivation, honestly. You know, but look at you were meeting up. You were coming against a machine there, really, that was so well oiled, that, and they had so many options, probably, which was decisive in the end, was the amount of good options they had to change their tack a little bit. Very smart outfit, and they're doing things from a coaching point of view that I think were actually decisive on the day, and that they were able to manufacture and engineer things a little bit for scores at times. That close games like the drawing game particularly come down to that bit of engineering, and they were so you have to give them every credit. But yeah, it would have been it was a big moment, and I think, yeah, I don't know what the boys on the inside were like. Sure, obviously they were aware of it, and their young side as well, so you know, you mightn't be heaping that on them. It's probably more for an older guy. At 2007, I was in my late 20s. I was well able for that kind of pressure as such, like, not that more than motivation, I found it, but it could be pressure for a younger guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah, going back to the Noel O'Leary, Cork won the All-Ireland, Paul, in 2010. And ironically, and you can dispute me on it, I do think that that's probably the year. Was that your finest ever, I was going to say your finest ever hour, but if you remember, the game went to extra time down in Páirc Uí Chaoimh. I don't know what age you were 10 years ago. That was 2010, I'm pretty sure. So take 10 years from what you are now. Was that your finest ever performance, even though it didn't ultimately lead to an All-Ireland? It led to victory that day. But I thought that was probably your best ever 90 minutes in a Kerry jersey.
Well, I suppose the thing about that game, Tony, was I didn't play the full game. I only came on. I didn't start the game. I came on in both of those games. The replay was in Killarney, and I played the last 20 minutes of that. And then I came on, I think, just before halftime, I'd say, in the replay in Cork. And so, I don't know. I certainly felt, I knew what I was about that day, actually. And I knew that, yeah, I had a lot of personal motivation that day. And I suppose, yeah, it was probably the height of that rivalry, I'd say, maybe. That 2010 was probably the height of that rivalry. You look at after that, it fizzled out a little bit after that. I think that was probably the peak of the rivalry, though, over those two games. And I was 30, good age, and I knew what I was about at that stage of the game. But I would feel, to be honest with you, I would feel probably 2012 as a year was probably the year I played my best football for Kerry, actually. But that stuff that stuff gets lost when you don't win All-Irelands and that. But I would feel consistently at 2012, I was at my best, probably most consistently.
Like, again, and I recall as well, by that stage in your career, Paul, 2009, 2010, 2012, you were actually one of the best kickers on the team. I mean, when Kerry were working that diagonal stuff, you know, more often than not, like, the ball was in your hand. But I mean, I remember you earlier, and I wouldn't have put you down as, well, I'm not being disparaging, but I wouldn't have put you down as a very good kicker of the ball. Would you agree that it was a part of your game that turned you from a good competitive player into an extremely good footballer?
Yeah, I think there came a point for sure. And it came a point where I knew I had to improve on the ball. And, you know, you learn that from your teammates. And you learn it on the training ground, you know. And, like, you're not delivering for guys like Gooch or like Declan or like Johnny Crowley and all the guys. I started off with guys like, I'm really more of an old school guy, Johnny Crowley and Liam Hassett and Mike Frank inside, like, so. But particularly, say, Gooch, like, you're not delivering for these players. You know about it. And you know that, you know your level. And I would have been, to be honest with you, Johnny, I always had a good ability to pass the ball. But when you go into senior, into county level, there's a composure aspect that comes into play, and the game is a bit faster. And so I knew I had the technique to pass, and I knew I had ability to pass, but I had to talk myself down a little bit into being more comfortable with the ball, knowing I can deliver a pass. And I had to practice as well then. And the composure came through practice, really. Composure on the ball came through practice. And this is a big thing would speak about to players a lot, and in Wexford particularly, this idea of practice. Football is a game of practice. And so I went off and practiced wall after wall, went to the field and practiced. I practiced and practiced, and I got better at passing the ball, and that's what happens. And if more footballers practiced, I think football would be a better game, but footballers don't tend to practice.
I thought you were really descriptive and on the money on Colm Cooper in your book. In terms of playing, and you know, you talk about practicing with him, like he would be your arch exponent of a guy who practiced. I'd say you must have loved not just playing in big games with him, but in empty stadiums in Killarney on a summer's night, working with him in a forward line, seeing and enjoying his movement and you being the student of the game that you are?
Yeah, I did. Honest to God, I really did. I felt besides Jack, probably besides Jack, he's the guy I learned more. I almost learned as much on the training ground looking at him. And I learned a lot from Jack now, I must say. Jack taught me a lot. Jack was brilliant when he was brilliant with me. But I learned as much almost from Gooch. And I do think footballers don't realise and should look more to their teammates for learnings and teachings, you know, because on the training ground, you look around, what's he good at? How is he good at it? What makes him good? Can I get better at that? You know, there's so much information on the training ground if you look around and are open to it. But I sometimes look, you have some teammates that are just out of level and you think, that's amazing to train with. You know, I remember him hitting a pass in Fort actually a couple of years ago in a training game. He pulled the pass out of the bag across the goal. It was like a cross in soccer. You never see that in the game. You know, you just go, whoa, no one ever does that. It was like a cross into the box. And Darren was coming in and Darren got a hand to it. I might have just gone wide, but like, you just think, you never see that in the game, you know? So exciting when you see it. So you do, and these fellas bring you up very quickly. And I was awful lucky because you see, fellas taught me about footballers and they think, what was Gooch like? What was Dara like? And I think, I say, okay, were you ever in the stand watching Dara go up into the air and catch a kick out? And the person will say, yeah. And I say, how did you feel when you saw that catch? And the person will say, incredible. I had goosebumps. I was up out of my seat, roaring. It was an amazing catch. And I said, no, can you imagine if you were standing under that catch, looking up at it? How would that feel? And I said, I can tell you that's a feeling of power. That's a feeling of motivation and inspiration. Mm. That's what it felt like to play with these guys. So whatever it felt like for you in the stand, it felt better for me to be on the pitch beside it, looking up at it or looking around at it. You know, so, you know, I was, that was my big motivation really for Kerry, was those opportunities to see these guys play. Jesus Christ, you just do the max you can to give guys like that the platform that they need. That's what football should be about, giving great players opportunity to play, you know?
I had Seamus Moynihan, Paul, on one of these chats, his pre-lockdown now. And I was surprised actually with his answer because I asked him that very same question. I said, if you were to walk down Mean Street in a bad neighbourhood, with one colleague that you played football with over the years, who would it be? And I thought he might fudge it, you know, but he didn't. Straight away, he actually said Dara Shea. And I says, why? And he says, because he was a guy, when we needed him in big moments, you know, he was there, he delivered, whether it was a catch, pulling something under the crossbar, scalping a fella, sorting somebody out. So if you're walking down a nasty neighbourhood and you needed one of those old soldiers with you, who are you bringing?
Yeah, it's hard to look past him from that point of view. I tell you, a guy I had a huge amount of time for as a teammate was William Kirby, actually. I had a really, and it's funny about, you know, you look at Kerry football and you think of the Kerry number eight being the, you know, big tradition of great number eights, you know, but we still haven't figured out our number nines, you know, and I think the number nine is almost more important to Kerry at the minute than the number eight position, like, and you need your number nines, like, and Kirby was a guy I loved playing with. I had a load of age, a load of physicality. He was smart. He did things that were needed. He did, you know, he was, that's that type that the Kerry team needs at number nine. You look back at the number nines like Ambrose and Shawnee and later on Donald Daly.
Seamus Scanlon.
Seamus Scanlon. Those guys, invaluable. They were the types I loved. And like, Kirby had a bit of street smarts as well. Like, and he was just very edgy and he knew how to impose himself and he could feel the game a bit as well. And so I think Kirby would be a guy, if I was on an alleyway now, he might be somebody I'd be looking for. That position is a key position for Kerry football, always has been, and it's one that I don't think we think about enough at times, you know, because it's a one that you need for balance in a team, you know.
Did you ever see, Paul, the film Legends of the Fall? Do you remember Brad Pitt?
No.
Kind of old American kind of movie, guy lost his way, like, but there was a great script at the end, and it was, you know, about like that by the time he got to his 40s, you know, that the bear had left him. You know, he was this wild child. I mean, and you know where I'm going with this. I often used to look at it and think, because he had the exact same beard, by the way, that you have now, by the time he was killed by this bear in the woods. The bear is gone from Paul Galvin. Was that going to happen anyway, or did marriage and becoming a dad just change your perspective? I know you're still competitive, but in terms of, you know, how you've changed as an individual, do you ever, on those long journeys, think about that?
I don't know, Tony. It's been put to me, like, it gets put to me at times, and that, I think, look, definitely there's no doubt marriage, I think, is a certainly... universally, I think, is a kind of a time when you go, all right, okay. And I'm not a settler as such, like, to be honest with you, as a person, I'm not that settled a person. I have a kind of a nomadic streak in me, and I like being on the move, and I need to be on the move. So I do absolutely think, like, you know, meeting my wife was a big time, big moment for me. Getting married, I think, is a thing in any man's life. Do you say, okay, look, it's time to settle down a bit now. But look, like, you look back as well at the trouble times and the kind of hassle, and you say, I just don't want any more hassle in my life. It's proud of it, like, honest to God, do you know? Because I mean, it was on a weekly basis almost at one point, and that becomes a thing where you just go, okay, like, what kind of a person do you want to be, and how do you want to be regarded? Like, you know, you probably have to become more aware of yourself, I think, with age, you know, and, like, you know, business as well. Then my work has been hugely rewarding for me, honestly. It has had a big effect on me as well, honestly. The what I do with Duns, that creative outlet, learning about business, dealing with people and around the boardroom, around shareholders of Duns, dealing with buyers, dealing with teams of people, which was huge. Actually, a big part of going to Wexford too was the experience I had in terms of working with four or five different departments, reporting to shareholders. That aspect of working life has been very, very good for me. Mm. And that has been just, yeah, I do think that's been a part. Obviously, marriage and family, and my little girl has become, like, you know, becoming a father is a new thing that you just haven't time. You just don't have as much time to be kind of getting involved in silly stuff, like, you know.
Yeah, I myself and my darling wife often say we were so busy and so crazy that we don't even remember our first two kids, kind of, actually, you know, we don't remember the baby phases, the baby stages. And I think, you know, I mean, that's important. I mean, the first five years could pass you by.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, and, you know, my book, Tony, right? My book as well was a big thing in my life, actually. It was the first time ever, because, you see, my whole career, really, I had no relationships. I had no relationships with people, really, bar my teammates. They were the relationships I had, and they were only the relationships I cared about, really. Like, even my family, like, I hadn't really a very normal relationship with my family, because I was just so consumed by Kerry. And, you know, it was I think writing my book was a moment as well where I sat back and said, wow, that was a lot. That was probably a lot. It was a lot for people around me as well. And, okay, you won a bit, but, like, you have to examine the other stuff as well. And you have to be honest with yourself and say, Jesus, you're fairly turned that upside down while you were at it. Do you know? So you get a new stage of life. Then you think, like, you know, think of other people around you, like, as well, which I didn't do a lot as a player, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Who was the colleague again, Paul? I have this story I remember you told me that I thought it was very enlightening. I don't know whether it was you or him. Were you afraid of water? And you took a deep dive on some team trip.
Yeah, we were on holidays in Jamaica with Kerry, and I see there was a cliff jump. And it was a big, I don't know, 20 or 25 metres. But Seamus Scanlon went off it one day anyway, and didn't he sit? He sat into the landing anyway. He landed in his arse, and he was black and blue for days after it. But I went back and I did that dive because I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep thinking about it, and I said, I have to do that. But I'm not the best swimmer, but I was told Star I was going anyway, and he says, can you swim? And I said, I can't. And he says, What are you going jumping off that for if you can't swim? I just want to do it, man. I just want to jump off and see what it's like, because it'll be a good buzz. And these are the things I like. I do find if I see anything adventure related or kind of risk related around me, I kind of get drawn to it. But anyway, I went and jumped off. Donny went off first off the cliff and he waited for me. I went down then. Brilliant buzz, like.
Yeah. So
that was him, like. He'd be a carer, like. Donny, he was a carer. I think great footballers are carers, like, you know. I think footballers care the most.
Yeah, but the key lesson for me out of that story, I remember now why it registered with me at the time, because there's a water park in Portugal that I used to go to, and there was a particular ride on it called the Banzai, and I'd say I was looking at it for 3 summers, and it used to just crack me up to leave the water park every year, and I didn't do it, and I said to myself, it actually used to consume me for days afterwards, until one time I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't let it go. And I remember when you told me that story, I was saying to myself, yeah, that was probably driving you mad now one night. You have to do that.
That night, I said I couldn't stop thinking about it. So the next morning, I said I went right back. The very next morning, the minute I woke, I went right back. And I just jumped in. And that was that. And Donny, he was in before me. But I did actually make a decision after I did that jump. You know, I made a decision that I was going to get out of teaching.
Really?
I did that jump, and I said, I'm going to live my rest of my life on my own terms completely, if I can. Not an easy thing to achieve, but when I came out of the water, I said, right, because it had been in my mind anyway for a year probably, that I needed to do what I'm doing now, because I had been looking at menswear for many a year, and I felt there was a lack of meaning in menswear, and I felt there was not, menswear was being underserved, and it wasn't saying or doing or didn't mean enough. And it was in my head for a long time. And then that jump was said, right, I'm going to take another leap now when I get back to Ireland. I did.
You were never, I don't think you were ever actually really cut out for teaching long term, Paul. Listen, is it, I know, here's me, no, this is a real name drop. Was it Paul Galvin or Michael Fassbender? Did you actually kind of hang yourself off the roof in a classroom and the kids were all below you? Was that
off
you?
Off a beam, yeah. It was steel beams in the sand. I climbed up it. I was doing all sorts of stuff. I was so obsessed with football at the start. I would have done all my stretching Tuesday and Thursday, last 10 minutes of class, get my stretching done for training. A lot of hand passing around the room. I'd get my eye in, but I kept the ball in the wardrobe. And sure, the boys loved it. They were all football mad anyway, most of them. And it was always good distraction as well, you know, like, because you can't, you know, you have to keep. So I would have done a lot of that. I did. I climbed up. I hung off a beam, all right, over their heads, and they didn't see me. And just came out of the ceiling like Spider-Man. They said, what?
Because I actually think, Paul, Fassbender, I heard a story that he did something similar to a teacher when he was a student in the SEM. I don't want to libel the man, no, like, but I actually think he kind of hung off the rafter. So obviously that was something that you could do in the classrooms in the SEM.
I don't know if you could or you couldn't, but I did it anyway. But I suppose it was a sign of the time. It was a sign of the fact that I was getting very frustrated with teaching, and I was kind of like, I went out the window another day. I went out the back window and around the thing, like, where there was a window near. I was near the entrance to the building, and I went out the window and in the entrance, back in the door to the top of the classroom, and like, just for fun, like, you know, first year, second year, third years have an amazing sense of fun. Boys that age have such a great sense of fun, and actually, they learn better if they see this kind of thing. They love it, and I found they loved it. I found it helped teaching actually.
I used to hide
in the wardrobe in them a bit. Go into the wardrobe. Was the day at all, come in and sit down, I'd come out of the wardrobe. Right, boys, books, bags, copies.
Do you still keep the notebook near at hand when you see a word that you really love and you say, I'm going to write that one down?
Yeah, I do. If you see behind my iPad here now is my whiteboard, and I have a lot of stuff written down there now, different notes for note-taking and just for my jobs, lists so that I get my jobs done or whatever, but a lot of language that I would lean on, like, you know. Language is a big part of my life, words, language, I'm a huge believer in. Listen, I don't need to tell you, you know what I mean? That's why I admire journalism and publishing, and I regard what I do with Dunstores as a form of publishing, through clothes. But I think words and language and the power of them when you examine them, there's a lot of problem solving and discovery to be had, you know.
I have to say, I remember you did begin to dabble in it very briefly. I think if you didn't go the route you went, I think you potentially would have finished up writing as a career, whether that was journalism or creative writing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And I think I may again. And I think it's actually no more than the coaching aspect. I just go on intuitions really a lot in life. And the coaching thing was an intuition whereby I wanted to explore these ideas in the game and get them out of my head, find out, do they work, do they not work? And writing is another one where I feel the need to do it. Same as I felt that need to go and do that with Wexford. I feel the need to talk about Harry Boland, one of the great GA figures who's probably not regarded as a GA figure at all. But you know, funny enough, he was central to the Kerry going to the Wexford thing. He became a factor in that whole Wexford thing as well, because I'm reading a lot about Harry Boland. The next thing I see, Harry Boland plays in the All-Ireland Hurling Final for Dublin 1907, chairman of Dublin County Board in 1911, referees the Kerry-Wexford All-Ireland Football Final 1914, drawn game. Dick Fitzgerald of Fitzgerald Stadium kicks the equaliser in the last minute. Kerry win the replay. Harry Boland's the referee. He then goes and manages UCD Collegians to the 1917 All-Ireland Hurling title. But that Harry Boland refereeing Kerry-Wexford All-Ireland Final was around the time I was kind of deciding whether I would do that or not. And I loved all the feelings and all the associations around it, you know. But I do feel the need to, write and discover and research. And the done stuff is all about that. And I felt, I the coaching stuff is too. I feel the same code. It's like the same code almost. So writing, I do think it's central. It's central to me, and I probably don't do enough of it, to be quite honest with you. I'm not doing enough of it at the moment.
Well, come here. If there was a few more Paul Galvins in the GA, my God,
it's getting more interesting. I think it's getting more interesting. And I think there's younger guys coming up now that I think might add a bit of colour to the game, you know?
Yeah. I must ask you, what's your perception from afar, or I don't know how afar you are, on David Clifford? You know, they're already putting him up on Mount Rushmore. I mean, what's your thoughts?
My thoughts are, I'm sorry, I missed him in the SEM. I was a couple of years in the SEM, and I had James O'Donoghue and Fionn and John Lyon and a couple, five or six of them that came through, but I was gone by the time he came through, sure. I mean, my perception is the same as everybody else is, really, Tony. You can only admire him as a footballer. I think the lockdown has been good for him. It looks like he's physically, looks like he's put on a layer of muscle. Seanie O'Shea the same. So I think lockdown will have helped him. I think you'd be very proud watching him as a player. It's just great that we can produce these guys. And then he's so similar in ways to Morris, and he's so similar in ways to Gooch. And you just can't ignore the culture of counties. And it's amazing to see this kind of production line of this kind of talent so similar to Morris. It's kind, it's a Gooch in him as well. And you just say, I'm just delighted we can produce these types of guys, you know. But he makes, watching him from afar, because the Kerry team now is none of my business, no more than the Mayo team is. I have my own learnings and reflections to be doing, Tony. But from afar, I'd say and this is more as much with East Kerry as anything, but he makes the difficult look easy. And you'd say to yourself, you'd like to maybe see it get a little bit easier from the point of view that he'll get possession and his man will tend to be still in the picture. And, it's a hop and a solo, and he's got to beat his man still. I would just look at it from a point of view of a wing forward or someone supplying him. As a player myself, if I put a pass inside to somebody, Gooch, Star, whoever, I'd be disappointed myself if the cornerback or the fullback was still in the picture after the pass.
Yeah.
You try to take somebody out if you can. And I suppose there's loads of reasons for that. And we will say he's in that year three as well. I think he's year three now. Is he year two or three?
He's actually year three. No, because he played in Eamon's last season.
Yeah, year three now. It's a big one for him, because I found as a player, year one and two, find your year one, it's all new, you're all energy. Year two, you're kind of finding your feet. You're still all energy, and you're a small bit of craft. Small bit extra craft. Year three, your energy plus the craft plus the know-how, and you your tree is a big one. I think he's shown the signs that he's now getting even more comfortable at this level. And when the team settles down around him, like the 10, probably he's a bit unfamiliar around him at times, but you know, he probably needs the 10 and 12 spots now to settle down, and the forward unit to settle down a little bit for him. I think that'll help him in terms of his movements and getting that chemistry with guys outside him, because 11 probably wouldn't find him a lot. Sean, he probably wouldn't find him a lot, but those wingmen would be big in the supply line. It looks like that those spots are settling down as well. But like you look at the likes of Dean Rock or Conor McManus getting possession in or on goal, very few plays and they're gone. It's almost shot on goal immediately, where the passing from the outside in is kind of doing the damage and he's just finishing.
Yeah.
I think for him, you know, when he gets old, especially when he gets older, having to take those plays and take guys on, it can take a toll. Eventually guys can start to get a hold of you and get hits on you and get throw a block on you, and you know, that's my only observation with him. Like, you know, I think it's a combination of the team settling and his own game developing in that. And
I'm intrigued. I mean, you spoke about the football community in London. I'm intrigued. You're living in a very passionate football community now in Mayo, and I just wonder what's your take. Not just on the Mayo team, I'm less interested in that at the moment, and more just on the Mayo football psyche.
I suppose, look, I'd be very mindful of the fact that I have to walk down the streets of Mayo these days. So, look, I suppose, what do I say? I don't know. They are like staunch supporters, and they do love their football. I haven't been exposed to the club scene here, and I think you can only understand the county's football and culture if you're kind of, if you've been at club games, watching regularly club games. I do believe that. I believe Kerry's football and culture is one thing, Wexford's is another, Cork's is another, Dublin's another, and Mayo's is another. So I haven't seen enough football to understand really what they're about in a football, from a footballing point of view. From the point of view of the public, as an observer, you'd see things that would maybe confuse you a little bit. Like, I remember, we'll say, league games. Like, I often got more disappointed and more hurt from losing a league game. Or not more, but as much from losing a league game at home than I did as I did an All-Ireland final. And that's not, I'm not overstating that now. I remember twice losing league games. We may have lost a few more, but we didn't lose too many. I would say two, maybe three. One was against Armagh and Tralee. And I was just devastated. I went off the field. I think winning at home is big. And I remember Dublin beating us today. Jack Connor's father passed away, and Dublin beat us in the league game. And like, they stayed with me, and they still remain with me. And then you see, we'll say, as an observer, Mayo and the Mayo support and how good they are. And they're obviously passionate, but then you wonder, are they too passionate? And you see, after a league game, for instance, you'd see things like the invasions onto the pitch after a league game. But I've seen... That's positive, of course. It's good for young people. It's good for young support. It's good for morale. And you could argue at the same time, for a team on a mission as Mayo are, right, and you lose a league game, sometimes I'm confused when I see they lose a league game and their supporters onto the pitch getting autographs off players, and some players, not all the players, and are surrounded for autographs. And I don't know, I just think losing at home in league football, I was always a huge believer in. You can win your All-Ireland. You can win your All-Ireland during the league. You can win. I'm a believer in that. You can win your All-Ireland during the league. And I just think losing league games at home is a big thing. It's a big marker. It's a big pointer. I'd be straight in the shower, and I'd be asking myself some hard questions, you know, as a footballer. And I think especially you lose that practice, always has confused me about Mayo football. Win or lose, I think I'd stop that practice. And that's not an issue for any manager or player or James Horan or anybody else, but it's one for the wider Mayo public, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
That feeds in a way to how they relate to the team, how the team relate to the support, and how the team relate to success and winning All-Ireland. Maybe. Merely an observation.
Yeah.
merely an observation.
How can I put this... They talk an awful lot, and they've been very, very close. And I actually feel at times, do they actually almost talk too much about football? I mean, do you understand my question even?
Yeah, no, I do. I put it to this way. Look, if you were to compare a Kerry person and a Mayo person, in my experience, probably, a Kerry person, you talk to a Kerry person, and the Kerry person goes, right, go on. Now, why did you say that now? And, you know what I mean? They're a bit more reticent, whereas the Mayo person is probably more talkative and more expressive and more outgoing. And maybe you're talking and he's talking and you're talking, we're all talking, you know, that kind of way.
I wonder, exactly.
Well, I wonder if the culture of the county, you know, it's funny that sometimes you look at the games they've played and the games they've lost and you see kind of patterns and you think, is anybody stopping and listening and examining? And just is that just the county's makeup that they kind of, they're sprinters maybe, you know, that kind of way? And this kind of, everything's 100 miles an hour. And I do think listening is a big thing. We spoke about it earlier, like a good footballer, he's a good listener, and listening is in itself, I think, is a part to play in success of in any field, be it football or business or whatever it might be. You have to be a good listener, and sometimes I wonder if it's linked to listening in that, you know, like who's examining the games, who's examining the reasons maybe for a defeat. The core stuff drives me mad. To be quite honest with you, the core stuff drives me mad. Like you hear way too much about that. For my liking, do you know what I mean? And I think there's a good bit of belief in the thing. Like, I think there's a bit of belief in that being cursed in that, you know. Which if it was the case, it could probably stop you from maybe looking into the nuts and bolts of games and performances and losses and that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Paul, great chat. Always good to meet and chat to you. Mind yourself.
Tony, a pleasure.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.